Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. I recently attended a great conference in Boston sponsored by Ceres, an organization that mobilizes business leaders and investors to integrate sustainability into their business practices. While some of the conference participants you might expect, like the socially conscious Ben & Jerry's, as well as Stonyfield, who makes the yogurt, many of the participants were high-level executives from Fortune 100 companies like PepsiCo, General Motors, and Levi Strauss. One of the biggest obstacles to climate change action identified is people's unwillingness to take climate change seriously. Of particular concern is climate deniers in the U.S. Congress who block passage of critical legislation. But there is hope that this obstacle can be overcome. In fact, one of the most interesting conference participants was Jerry Taylor, who was a paid climate denier for many years and who is now speaking out about the need for climate action. Mr. Taylor is my guest today on the show to tell his story. He will be followed by Rob Sargent of Environment America, a longtime environmental activist. Our first guest, Jerry Taylor, is the president and founder of the Niskanen Center, a libertarian think tank in Washington, D.C. Prior to founding the center in 2014, Mr. Taylor spent 23 years at the Cato Institute, where he served as director of natural resource studies, assistant editor of Regulation Magazine, senior fellow, and then vice president. Before that, Mr. Taylor was the staff director for the Energy and Environment Task Force at the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, funded largely by corporations and used as a policy source for many conservative state legislators. Over the past two decades, Mr. Taylor has been an influential libertarian voice in energy policy in Washington. He's the author of numerous policy studies, has testified before Congress, and his commentary has appeared in the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and other prominent media outlets. Jerry Taylor, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. Great to be on your show.
Yeah, I was delighted to meet you at the Ceres Conference and fascinated by your story. I'd like to start with, why did you invest so much to deny climate change for those many years that you did? Why was it a priority for you and those who were funding you?
Well, I was hired at the Cato Institute to be responsible for the energy and environmental policy work we did. And so I came on board in 1991 just as climate change politics was heating up and took center stage in my issue arena. And like a lot of right-of-center thinkers in the policy community in Washington, I was deeply skeptical of the argument for doing much about climate change. There were climate scientists that I knew who seemed to make fairly reasonable and sensible arguments against climate action. And from a conservative standpoint, talking about eliminating fossil fuels from the American economy in the course of a couple of decades is pretty bracing stuff. I mean, there's clearly going to be a lot of costs associated with that. And in the early 1990s, it didn't look as if it would be such an easy lift, so there'd be tremendous costs involved and tremendous uncertainties about the future costs of climate change. And so when you look at it in that fashion, it's fairly easy for someone on the right to conclude that we just simply don't know enough to completely remake the American economy with all the economic costs associated with that, and that we needed to wait until we had better information before we made a decision like that.
Very interesting. So you went out and you were speaking in a lot of venues at Congress and these media outlets about saying why we should not be taking action on climate change for the reasons you're saying, that, you know, it was uncertain that it was real or that humans were causing it, the costs were high, and mm-hmm. even the uncertainty about what the costs ultimately would be, but it looked like a very skyward price tag associated. So what changed your mind?
Yeah, you know, it is important to keep in mind that people in the skeptics camp or the climate denial camp are not people who believe that climate change is real, but they take money to argue to the contrary, or they're not primarily populated by individuals who are consciously going about making crappy arguments in the course of forwarding their agenda. There's a lot of motivated cognition here. So there's, and you also have to remember that for a lot of conservatives, they've been brought up in a world in which they've been able to identify plenty of times where the environmental community has cried wolf about a resource problem, which turned out to be greatly overwrought. So we had a population panic in the 1960s, and now, of course, we're seeing that that didn't quite play out the way we had hoped. When we were in, when I was in college, a lot of my peers were in college, we heard a lot about the imminent depletion of all the important natural resources on the planet, oil, coal, gas, minerals, our ability to feed ourselves, lots of Malthusian disasters on the horizon. They didn't play out. And so for a lot of conservatives, climate change is just one more of the same sort of wolf-crying operations by environmentalists. But I did change my mind on these topics. Now, the first thing that happened is I began to lose faith in the skeptics' narrative on the science. The point here is that, look, I'm not a scientist. Most of my peers aren't scientists. But you don't have to necessarily be a scientist to understand the issues in play. Most of your listeners aren't scientists, and they probably have pretty firm opinions about these matters. But since I was in the business of debating the best and the brightest on either side, I found that a lot of the narratives I was forwarding, once I gave them close scrutiny because I was called on it, it turns out that those narratives weren't very impressive. But, you know, it's human nature not to do a great deal of due diligence to the arguments you want to forward if they have a lot of utility for your case. But I did that, began to do some of that due diligence once I realized that some of the arguments that my friends in the scientific community were forwarding were misleading, they were not particularly compelling, they mischaracterized the literature. And that gave me a great deal of pause since I didn't want to be in that business. And that began the domino effect that took me from climate skeptic to someone who believes we need to do something about climate change.
That's just an amazing story to me, and I love the fact that you're actually kind of looking at the data and looking at the arguments, and you actually got persuaded by reason and logic and data that what you had been saying was not as accurate as what you're now saying, that there is climate change, it's real, and we need to take action. And I just so respect you, you know, as someone who had been a climate denier, to really look deeply at the arguments of those who are saying this is a problem, we need to take action. And as you look deeply at those arguments, go, you know what, there's actually concerns here. And so good for you for being willing to change your mind.
Well, thank you. I think it has less to do with anything about personal integrity or seriousness of purpose than what one's mission is in these policy discussions. For a lot of my peers on the right, or from the center-right or libertarian community, since libertarians aren't necessarily going to volunteer the proposition that they are of the right, but for a lot of people in the policy debate, their job is not to persuade. Their job is to enforce an orthodoxy in their community. And I think that probably is the case also on the progressive side of the fence and amongst liberals. And I don't think there's anything unique, uniquely about conservatives in this debate that that make them more inclined to police orthodoxy than to, say, try to persuade. Because policing orthodoxy is very easy, right? You can get very purple-faced. You can pound the table. You can sneer and snarl at your opposition. You can make sarcastic remarks. You can score clever points, all of which turn off everyone who isn't already in your camp. But you're keeping the people in your camp because you're giving them a good you're giving them a good show, and you're throwing big bolo punches that sound fairly plausible. If that's your job, if that's the way you look at your role in this world, then it's not all that important to wrestle with the best arguments on either side. You could ignore the arguments from either side because most of your crowd, the people you're trying to keep in line, the people you're trying to keep on your side of the fence, they're not in the business of critically looking at the arguments from either side either. For instance, how many people who listen to this show take seriously arguments offered by, you know, free market economists on a whole host of things. Probably not too many. And that's no knock on your audience. There are not, a lot of people I know do not take very seriously anything Paul Krugman has to say, even though they probably should. The reality is we read things that are designed to confirm things we already believe. So if you're not in the business of persuasion, then it's very easy to just kind of shrug your shoulders at this stuff, to ignore the arguments that are tough, to mischaracterize and to be glib and not think too deeply about them, because you're never going to get called out. But there are some people in my world, just like there are some people on the left and some people in all political, in all the political spaces we might think about, whose ambitions are a little bit greater. We want to persuade. We want to bring people over to our side of the fence. We want to make a compelling argument. We want to wrestle and win with the very best arguments the other side has to offer. We're not going to cherry pick and go down the food chain and pick out the stupid arguments and smack them around, and score cheap points. We want to take on the best. So it has something to do with professional ambition, perhaps. And for people in the on the right in the climate debate, those whose ambitions are more aligned with what my ambitions were at the Cato Institute have, for the most part, left climate skepticism, left climate denialism, and find themselves in a different place. And I think that's mostly because if you really do seriously examine and do your intellectual due diligence in this debate, it's very, very, very hard to hold a position of no action. It's just very hard.
That's great. And one of the things you mentioned in our conversation in Boston was that as you looked more deeply into the arguments of those calling for climate action, you said you're looking at it going, well, what is the risk if the climate change activists are right? What if this is, you know, man-made changes in the climate because of carbon emissions? And if we do disrupt the weather patterns, disrupt the oceans, have more severe weather, floods, and so forth, that the risk, if they were right, it was actually very high, and that that alone merited some action to address it in case there was truth on that.
Yeah, to me, one of the most important arguments that caused me to pivot was the observation that a fellow that I was sitting down and talking to in my office had made, in which he said, look, this debate that you're engaged in about the most light, about climate change and whether we should act, is generally a very hot dispute about the most likely outcome from climate change. And so your community says the most likely outcome is that this will be a relative non-event with only modest climate and social and economic impacts. And it just turns out that you can indeed go into the academic peer-reviewed literature and find articles, plenty of them actually, which argue that the future warming that we can expect in the 21st century will probably be on the lower end of what the IPCC considers its most likely range. So most of the credible climate skeptics do not depart from the estimated range of future warming that the IPCC offers. They will put their chips on the very, very low end of that. And if there are no low probability, high impact scenarios to play themselves out, and we're on the very low impact end of that, you could make an argument that this is going to be less of an event than some people fear. But on the other hand, there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty. Of course, on the left, we argue, no, the most likely outcome is going to be higher and more significant warming. But this is the wrong debate, this fellow said. It's not that the most likely outcome from climate change is not the most important consideration in this debate. The most important consideration in this debate is a recognition of the full range of possible outcomes. So, for instance, and we consider these sorts of things all the time. For instance, if we're in financial markets, we're trying to invest our money, what's the most likely outcome in any given year? Well, the most likely outcome is the stocks are going to return better than anything else. And so if you make your investments based on most likely outcome, you're going to put 100% of your money into equities, and you'll probably just park it into an index fund and walk away. That would be the best use of your money if that's how you make your decisions about finance. We don't do that, right? Because we know that might be the most likely outcome. But there's a full range of other outcomes that are quite possible. And those outcomes present risks that we want to hedge against. And when we talk about foreign policy, this is part of our vocabulary. We know the most likely outcome of, say, Iran having nuclear weapons is that nothing much comes from it, because, after all, India has nuclear weapons, Pakistan has nuclear weapons. They're in dangerous parts of the world where conflict is common, and yet there's been no use of nuclear weapons. But there is a chance that there are less likely outcomes that are significant, which is why people concern themselves with the proliferation of nuclear weapons throughout the world. We look at that the risk when it comes to foreign policy, for instance, when it comes to ISIS and Islamic terrorism. The most likely outcome is the United States is not going to face some sort of existential threat to its future or anything of the kind. But there are low probability, high impact scenarios that conservatives are concerned about. So why isn't in the climate discussion, we don't acknowledge the full range of possible outcomes and hedge against them, just as we would in any other context, in any other policy conversation, were it not labeled climate change? Well, that didn't make any sense to me. And if you look at the full range of possible outcomes from climate change, there are some very, very alarming scenarios that are very plausibly in play, that have extremely high beyond catastrophic costs that we simply cannot ignore. And if you do that, then it's almost dispositive. It absolutely compels action. And that was a light bulb that went off. I had, it sounds obvious when you say it, but at the time I hadn't thought a great deal about that. I was entrenched, like so many people in this debate, including people on the left, with a hot dispute about what the most likely outcomes are, not what the full range of possible outcomes are. And if you take into account that full range of possible outcomes and you don't try to, try to pretend that risk hedging is something of a communist plot or something, then it really compels action. And so that was one of the things that had a big impact on moving me from point A to point B.
That's impressive, and I'm so happy you made that journey from point A to point B. Now that you're kind of, that light bulb has gone off and you see it's important to take action given the potential catastrophic impacts and certainly likely major impacts, what do you think needs to be done about climate change? I assume as a libertarian you would support market-based solutions to slow carbon emissions?
Well, as somebody who has a very healthy respect for the power of markets, absolutely. We know that price signals are powerful things in a market economy. Prices impact the decision making of every single person in the United States and can impact them quite significantly. If we want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the United States and around the world, we are going to have to marshal the power of consumers, and the best way to do that is to price carbon to reflect the risks that are being imposed by its use. If you do that, according to not just libertarian economists, but even according to, activists on the left like James Hansen and Al Gore, they fully understand that we will get far more emissions reductions far quicker by simply pricing carbon and letting market actors respond. Then we're going to, by turning loose regulatory agencies to micromanage and regulate every nook and cranny of the American economy. That is a very slow process. It is excessively expensive. And the more costly it is to reduce emissions at the margin, the less emissions reductions we're going to be able to buy as a society. And it's not going to do the job fast enough. We need to immediately act. We need to immediately act aggressively. And the regulatory initiatives from the Obama administration, while better than nothing, I fully concede that if my choices are no action whatsoever versus the Clean Power Plan and production tax credits and the various things that are part of present policy today, yes, I absolutely would prefer present policy to a policy of no action. But there are policies that, if you aggregate the emissions reductions that are going to follow, are a drop in the bucket of what's needed. And it's very, very hard to imagine a scenario where we're going to decarbonize the American economy to a large extent by the middle part of this century, primarily based on brute regulatory force with entrenched opposition out of the Republican Party every single step of the way.
Yes, I think you put your finger on it. We need to put a price on carbon. It's probably the single best thing that we can do. And it's interesting, I recently had dinner with Gro Brundtland, the former Prime Minister of Norway and the head of the Brundtland Commission, which came out with the whole idea of sustainable development. And I asked her what she thought the most important thing we need to do to deal with climate change, and she said we need to put a price on carbon. And so, you know, however you get there, we need to put a price on carbon. And it would seem to me, and we had some conversation about this, putting a price on carbon is going to be probably the most appealing way to engage libertarians and conservatives to take action, because they're certainly not going to be wanting to call for more government regulation.
Well, that's right. I mean, right now, the default, let's assume Congress does nothing. Let's assume Republicans and conservatives and libertarians do nothing. Then we are on a trajectory of near endless regulation under the Clean Air Act executed by the EPA throughout the American economy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That's if there is no change in policy. So the default is not no action. The default is regulatory action. And so for someone on the right of center, it should be an absolute no-brainer to conclude that it is far better to have market actors decide when, where, and how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions as a consequence of price signals than it is to have the questions of when, where, and how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions being made by regulatory planners at EPA or in state regulatory agencies, and to try to execute the decarbonization by rulemaking rather than by market power. This should be an easy decision, even if you're skeptical of climate science, even if you think that there's no real strong case for federal action. The fact is that policy ship, that political ship has sailed. We are acting, and we will continue to act. The only question is, can we do it cheaper and better? And I think that libertarians and conservatives are uniquely positioned to offer ideas to allow us to do it cheaper and better through carbon pricing. And as you mentioned, Gro Brundtland isn't the only person who's thought of on the left who embraces this idea. I mean, I've talked to a number of environmentalists, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, for instance, who fully appreciates and understands the case for using markets to do this job. And so I think this should be a relatively compelling sell to the right. The problem is that, well, while there's a lot of denialism on the right about climate science, I think there's also a lot of denialism about climate politics and American politics. A lot of my former colleagues on the right firmly believe that they're winning this debate, that the politics works in their favor to take this position. They don't believe the polls that show that most people are alarmed about climate change and want government action. Or if they do believe the polls, they say, that'll change as soon as the hiatus and warming, which has gone on for 18 years, now goes on for 25 and 30. Sooner or later, America's going to wake up and realize that this was a hoax all along, just like the hoaxes with regards to the population bomb and resource depletion, and then we'll be proven right. We just need to hold the line. That's the mentality on the right. If really that's how you feel, if you really believe that, then when I argue that carbon pricing is certainly better than regulation, on the right, that's interpreted as it's certainly better for General Lee to walk to Appomattox Courthouse and sign surrender papers at General Grant to keep fighting it out. And conservatives and libertarians are not going to so easily sign those surrender papers when they think the stakes are as high as they are, and when they think that ultimately they're going to be proven correct about climate change. And I tell you, most of the people that I used to work with at the Cato Institute and elsewhere really did believe that sooner or later the science and the data is going to show them correct.
Fascinating. Well, many of our listeners are involved in climate action, and they're meeting with members of Congress to try to spur, and you know, also members in the state legislature to try and spur various actions to deal with climate change. What would you recommend are the best ways to talk to climate deniers?
Well, you're never going to turn a climate denier into a climate alarmist by being really well briefed on the science, believe me. It turns out that surveys have been done on this. The more someone knows about the science, the more entrenched they become in whatever position they presently have. So you're not going to really win these conversations, in my opinion, by doing a full frontal assault on the science. It turns out, in other surveys have found that climate skeptics are as well versed, if not somewhat better versed, in the scientific literature and in the science arguments than are people who are more alarmed about climate change. There are a lot of different reasons for that. I don't find their arguments compelling, as I said, but it's not as if your average climate denialist, who's, you know, ginned up and ready for an argument, is a mouth breather who doesn't know anything. It's usually quite the opposite. So what I think is important to remember when dealing with people who are opposed to action is that most of the people on the right fear the implications of turning government loose to strip carbon fossil fuels out of the American economy and to control its energy use and to deindustrialize, which is what they think is going to follow from taking fossil fuels out of the economy. They fear that and turning government loose to do this job more than they fear the potential consequences of climate change. That's really the rub of it. And so if we want people on the right who are skeptical of climate action to become to move into a better space in this debate, we have to make sure that they appreciate the fact that one can address climate change without giving a massive steroid to governmental power, without tearing the economy apart and turning it into, say, Amish Pennsylvania, and without imposing massive costs on the American people. Because that's what really drives climate skepticism. It's not so much the science. It's more the fear of the implications of embracing it. And to the right, embracing the risks, or at least acknowledging the risks of climate science, by necessity requires us to have government act in a pretty aggressive fashion. And that scares hell out of conservatives. Now, happily, I think there are ways that we can address climate risks without increasing the size of government, without surrendering industrialization, without having to, you know, make a social decision to live like the Amish, without paying massive wealth loss in the course of doing so. But that has to be, in my opinion, the main focus when talking to climate skeptics.
Fascinating. So you're saying the best way to talk to the climate deniers is, you know, just don't even get into the scientific debate.
You can get into it a little bit when somebody tells you something like, you know, I mean, there's no way to completely dodge this issue, but you have to remember, it's like when you're, if you're having an argument with your husband or your wife, oftentimes the argument's not, whatever the topic is you're arguing about, that's not really what's going on. There's oftentimes something else that's really animating this argument. And you have to remember, when it comes to climate science, it's much the same thing. There's going to be this argument about science, but that's not really the issue here. The more underlying and important issue is conservative opposition to a large, expansive, powerful, intrusive government which chokes economic growth and human well-being. That's what concerns them. And their fear that if they turn loose government to address climate change, that's going to happen. And that's what you have to keep in mind when talking to them.
Fascinating. And so how are your conversations going? Presumably you're talking to your former colleagues at Cato Institute and at ALEC. What are you saying to them? How are they responding to you now that you've got a different perspective on climate change?
Well, it's a very diverse community, so it's very hard to make generalizations. People who are paid to engage in climate debates on the right are going to hold on to their position like grim death. There's no changing them. Or, you know, maybe there is. I used to be one of those people, and I changed, so it's not impossible to imagine. But for the most part, those are the toughest sells. There are people who work in these organizations. They may not be responsible for working on energy and environment. Maybe they're there because they work on tax policy, or they work on immigration, or they work on criminal justice or something of that nature. There are a lot of people who work in the libertarian world and on the right who think that climate change is a real problem and think we probably should act. It's just not their issue area. And because they work in these organizations, they tend to be quiet about it, because that's not a popular position to have within the tribe. But we find that now that we're speaking out a bit, a lot of those folks are, you know, kind of coming out a little bit, as it were. We're giving them permission to be a little heterodox. So we are finding that there's more agreement with us than you might think from looking at the press. And then, of course, there are libertarians and conservatives who are not associated with institutions in Washington, who are in academia or public life or what have you. And they're far different. And there's far more agreement amongst, say, libertarians that climate change is a significant problem. If you're looking at libertarians who happen to be in academia, there's in fact pretty widespread acknowledgement that mainstream science is probably correct on this topic and that we need to act. They're just not people who are being paid by institutions to go about making these arguments, say, in Washington, D.C. But more important than trying to move the institutions to the right, in my opinion, is trying to move elected Republicans. Because ultimately the decision about whether to act or not to act, to price carbon or not to price carbon, is made by elected officials in Washington. So our main focus is with them. And what we've found in talking to Republicans in the House and the Senate and senior committee staff and senior Republican staff is that there is far more willingness to entertain the idea that the Republican Party is in an unsustainable political position with their policy of denial, and they are probably in a bad policy space as well, and that they need to move out of it. The question is, how can they move out of it politically without cutting off their nose in spite of their face? And so that's really the trick here, is to take a lot of this subterranean support for what we are arguing here at Niskanen and translate it into political action. And that's what we do. And to the extent to which we at the Niskanen Center talk to these other actors at AEI and Heritage and the Chamber of Commerce and whatnot, that's all means to an end. Because these folks have some degree of influence over Republicans, though I think oftentimes their influence over Republican officials is somewhat overstated. So we want to try to move their needles, but ultimately our job is to move the needles of elected officials. And in that regard, I'm really somewhat surprised at how much latent support there is for carbon pricing in the House and the Senate and the GOP. It's subterranean, and it is latent, but it's certainly pregnant with possibilities, and it's there.
So you think there is some latent support there for carbon pricing, and if it was approached in the right way, we might actually be able to get some carbon pricing through Congress?
I think so. I think that the main roadblock to having a much healthier conversation on the right about this topic is the fear that if you acknowledge climate change is a real problem that we have to deal with by using carbon pricing, then you'll become Bob Inglis. Some of your listeners may remember Congressman Inglis from South Carolina lost a primary challenge to a Tea Party candidate, Trey Gowdy, in 2010, I believe it was. And one of the reasons that the Tea Party ran a challenge against him in the Republican primary was that he supported a carbon tax bill. That was not the only reason, but it was one of the reasons, and he lost. And at that time, you know, people forget, before the Tea Party came on the American political scene with force in 2010, the Republican Party looked kind of different on this. As recently as 2008, they nominated a presidential candidate in John McCain, who was as bullish about doing something about the risks associated with climate change as was Barack Obama. He supported cap and trade. He had bills to that effect under his name. You had major Republican leaders like Newt Gingrich endorsing cap and trade and climate action. You had people like Jeff Flake and a whole host of others who would endorse this. Now, of course, they've disappeared from the scene. Why? Their minds haven't changed. Believe me, I know that John McCain's mind about climate change has not changed at all. But what has changed is the fact that since 2010 in the Republican Party, a very robust and powerful Tea Party movement has come onto the scene and is holding the party hostage. If you vote this way on climate, we will run a candidate against you and knock you out. And they have Bob Inglis' scalp to show for it, and that has paralyzed the GOP. So people who used to speak out have gone silent. But I think that time, this era in Republican politics, the Tea Party era, is in my opinion, probably about to come to an end with November. I don't think that the Tea Party is going to fare very well in the November elections. My hunch is that it's more likely than not that they take the Republican Party over a cliff with the Trump candidacy, and then we're going to have a new conversation in the GOP, because it's going to become increasingly clear, in my opinion, to a lot of Republicans that you can choose to please the Tea Party or you can choose to please people who aren't in the Tea Party, and you can't do both. If you're gerrymandered in a district where the Tea Party has control, then fine. But those districts are going to become fewer and fewer with time. They're already becoming very few. And if you have a general election campaign, then of any real consequence, then you're really in danger by holding this position. And I think that we're going to see some evidence to that effect in November. And once we see that, I think that's going to change the politics in Washington quite a bit, and it's going to change the willingness of the GOP to entertain this conversation.
That's a very hopeful analysis. I hope you're right. We're at our time here, but how can listeners learn more about your work?
Well, you can go to our website, niskanencenter.org, where we have a very active blog, as you might imagine, which discusses climate change. Our job is to better inform the conversation on the right, so often that means taking a critical eye at, say, a Heritage Foundation paper arguing against climate action, so we'll take a close look at that. We also write quite a bit about things in the that's going on in the political world and the scientific literature. So you're welcome to go there. I also think an excellent organization for listeners who are interested in being more directly involved in climate policy or climate politics is Citizens Climate Lobby, and they do a wonderful job here in Washington, and we work closely with them, and they provide a lot of opportunities for people to get involved in a productive fashion.
That's great, and that's all the time we have. Jerry Taylor, thank you so very much for being with us today and for your important work.
Oh, thank you, Eleanor. It's great to be on your show.
Our next guest is Rob Sargent, Energy Program Director at Environment America. Rob has over three decades of experience leading a wide range of environmental and public interest campaigns. As a policy advisor and strategist, he's helped build citizen and stakeholder support to win concrete policies to advance clean energy and to limit climate-altering carbon pollution. Rob has authored and co-authored many reports. Energy Program Director at Environment America. As a policy advisor and strategist, he's helped build citizen and stakeholder support to win policies that advance clean energy and limit climate-altering carbon pollution, including We Have the Power, 100% renewable energy for clean, thriving America, the way forward on global warming, and lighting the way, the top 10 states that helped drive America's solar energy boom in 2014. Rob is a 1982 graduate of the University of Vermont. Rob Sargent, welcome to All Together Now.
Thanks, Eleanor.
I was so happy to see you at the Ceres Conference and to know you're still doing your great work, and I love your reports there, particularly the idea about moving towards 100% renewable energy. What do you see now as the biggest challenges we're facing in meeting our energy needs?
I think the biggest challenge we're facing is not the not the availability of pollution-free energy and not the public support for it. I think the biggest challenge we face is the political will and kind of the vision to imagine that it makes sense to figure out how to make orient our economy and make the kind of investments that give us access to pollution-free energy, which, as it turns out, most of those options are also have no fuel costs. And so, there's a set of economic stakeholders who, like the oil industry, the coal industry, that have a stake in the current way we do things. But for most people and most institutions and most businesses, unless you're directly associated with pulling oil out of the ground and selling it, or coal out of the ground and selling it, you really don't have a stake in that. And so we need to make the case to people that both because we can, it just makes sense, and most people would, all things being equal, like pollution-free energy over dirty energy, and also because we must, because we're facing, I heard the tail end of your last speaker, but, you know, we're facing a climate crisis that's the result of, a bunch of fuels not being held account for the pollution they're putting in the atmosphere and the cost they're imposing on society as a whole. So I think the biggest obstacles are economic stakeholders, and then, you know, really the political will to do it. The thing is, I think things are changing. We'll talk about that, but I think we're moving very quickly. We're reaching a tipping point on people's sense of the possible on getting to 100%, and I think we just need to lean into it.
Yeah, that's great. So where are we at now? I mean, I know we've had some amazing recent progress with solar power tripling in the U.S. in just the past 2 years. So we're making very rapid progress. But what percentage of U.S. energy now comes from renewables?
It's a very small fraction. Non-large hydro renewables, you know, you're talking maybe 5% or so, but the rate at which it's growing, if we grow by even a fraction of the rate that wind and solar have been growing over the past handful of years, we really are on track. And then you layer in people finally figuring out that saving energy, capturing the vast amounts of wasted energy is an economic and an environmental interest in doing that, and rapid advances in both in technologies way beyond what people would have imagined even a handful of years ago. Solar is solar's declined. Wind power since between 2009 and 2014, wind power declined by almost 60%. Solar declined by almost 80%. And then even other major advances like LED lighting, which makes, you know, we were used to talk about compact fluorescent lights compared to the incandescent lights. Well, LED lighting is to incandescence is to CFLs is as the CFLs were to the incandescence. It's just tremendously more efficient way of lighting, and it's beginning to, you know, like I was at a hardware store the other day and, you know, bought a 4-pack for, you know, $6, and, you know, those, they would have cost, you know, $10 a piece, you know, even a couple of years ago. So, there's all sorts of advances that we're seeing, and we're also seeing major players really understand this, right? Whether it's Fortune 500 companies, of which there are literally dozens who have made a serious commitment and meeting all of their energy needs with clean renewables. Companies like Google and Facebook and Walmart and Coca-Cola. I mean, there's just a whole range of companies. It's not just small businesses that are thinking about this. So I think corporate America is waking up to this, and the beauty of moving to 100% renewables is that that almost everybody is a stakeholder in it, because it's capital intensive to invest in it, but then all of the money spent on it primarily is spent locally. Even if solar panels are made in China, you can't outsource the jobs that install them.
Right.
And the more solar panels we make in the U.S., the more interested the manufacturers are going to be in being closer to those markets. So, and you're starting to even see that happen. So it's, the applications are so wide that really everybody becomes a stakeholder and a winner if we do it right.
Yeah, so how soon do you think the U.S. could become 100% renewable energy sourced?
Tell me,
my lifetime.
Eleanor, I think it's in your lifetime.
All right.
I think we're going to start seeing, you and I are both old enough to remember when it was a big deal when you'd see a hybrid on the road,
right.
A hybrid car. And now there's 15 or so manufacturers not only making them and coming off the assembly line, but marketing them. They never used to market them. It was just a little niche product that, you know, early adopters would buy. The cost of those are coming down. As a result of that, the cost of batteries are coming down. As a result of that, the cost of batteries that can help store energy are coming down, which is helping to, make it, address some of the issues around, you know, that the sun doesn't shine at night and be able to store, the renewable energy for times when you need it. So, I think it's wholly realistic that the entire planet by the middle of the century will be 100% powered by renewables, and that it will be, and that our kids will be, wondering why the heck we had internal combustion engines and who was it that, why did we have to go through a fossil age to get to the solar and wind age? Those resources were there to begin with. And so,
you just say you thought the whole planet would be 100% renewable by mid-century?
Yeah.
By 2050?
Yep.
That's encouraging.
Right. And I have to believe that. I know we can do it. And so, our challenge is to persuade people that investing in pollution-free energy, which most people agree, all things being equal, is something we would strive for. And if you don't care about that, investing in energy resources that have no fuel costs, simply makes sense. We have, and I think the United States leading is critical for two reasons. One, as the people who have dumped the country that's dumped the most carbon into the atmosphere over time, we have an obligation to the rest of the world to lead. But the other thing is that we should be leading and providing opportunities for our companies and our technologies to be, winning in the global marketplace around bringing clean renewables to the world as opposed to, dirty technologies. And so I think it's a huge opportunity for us to lead. It's a huge opportunity for, to create economic development opportunities. It's a huge opportunity to ensure, if we do it right, to ensure that the benefits of clean energy flow to all, that we acknowledge that the disenfranchised and low-income people will tend to be pay a higher percentage of their monthly income on energy, and two, are disproportionately affected by the impacts, whether it be the impacts of climate change or the impacts of the pollution associated with the drilling, burning, transportation of, fossil fuels. So, I think you're gonna, we'll have this conversation in 5 years and we'll be that much further along. But it's going to take a lot of work, and there's a lot of resistance, it's really, really important for us to recognize, we have to, because we have no choice, if we want to avoid the worst impacts of global warming, and while we're at it, avoid all the other environmental consequences from the cradle to grave, uses, the drilling, the mining, the transportation, the pollution from refineries and all the other impacts we have from our current energy mix. That's before you even have something come out of the tailpipe or the smokestack. So we know we have to, and we know we can, and so we just have to decide to do it. And once enough people decide to do it, there'll be the political will to put the policies in place to make that happen. Where every indication is the policies we have today are working. We can fine-tune them. We can make them. We need to make them better and accelerate the rate at which we're doing it. But it's, we can get there.
Yeah, and you wrote the report about how we could have 100% renewable energy in America. Is that your major focus now on renewable energy?
Well, obviously it overlays almost everything we do on energy and climate. In order to meet our climate targets, we need to rapidly accelerate clean energy. We do a lot of work on solar and wind and other things, which are pieces of that puzzle. But we've made a very, burning oil, gas, and coal, and our other fuels have polluted our air, water, and land for decades, and it's changing our climate faster than anybody, faster than scientists feared it would even a few years ago. And so, we know we can have healthy communities. We know we can have a livable future for our kids. But we have to transform the way we use our energy. And really, I think just beginning to say, let's have a goal of making it 100% clean renewables, using less energy, being smarter about how we use it, and then transitioning, rapidly ramping up clean renewables, and having that phase out the dirty stuff is really what we need to be doing to meet our environmental challenges. The good news is, it's not like we don't spend money on energy today. It's not like updating our infrastructure, even in the current paradigm, isn't going to cost a lot of money. We're going to spend a lot of money on energy either way. But investing in clean energy and access to clean energy provides us access to, in most cases, energy that has no fuel costs or measures that have help us save energy. And so it's common sense that we should be doing it anyway. And really, with the exception of the coal and oil industry and the fossil fuel industry, everybody can be a winner. And there'll be many fewer losers if we do this right and we do it quickly.
Yeah, and as you say, this is a huge opportunity in business. U.S. companies can really make a lot of money in the national and global market on renewables. It's interesting that it was the U.S. that was in the forefront of solar technology back in the 70s, and then we kind of lost the political momentum and kind of fell by the wayside, and other companies picked it up. China's now doing a lot with solar panels, and European countries. So we kind of lost the leadership role, but I think we can really step it up. And when Americans set our mind to it, we have incredible ingenuity and can do great things.
That's exactly right. And I think there's no turning back. It's just a question of on the direction that we're headed on renewables. I think that, the business community as a whole, with many exceptions, but more and more of the thoughtful, forward-thinking business leaders are recognizing this fact, both in terms of how they use their own energy, how their use of energy affects their relationships with civil society, but then more importantly, as you point out, the opportunities to actually win in the marketplace we're beginning to see. And so I think that's right. And then obviously it isn't all about just business. It's about the quality of life for Americans and what their neighborhoods look like and the health of our kids and our grandkids and the future of the planet in the case of climate change. So, there's a lot of reasons to do it, even if it didn't make economic sense and business sense. But that said, obviously there's, I think, for all the reasons we've discussed, plenty of reasons to do it for that too.
Yeah, and you mentioned you heard some of my interview with Jerry Taylor, who was a paid climate denier who looked carefully at the arguments and now is speaking out about climate change action. What do you think of what Jerry Taylor is doing and his ability to speak to libertarians and conservatives and help bring them, shift them away from climate denial into being willing to move towards climate action, say through carbon pricing?
I mean, we absolutely need to talk to each other more and stop being in our silos. And so, which I think is in part what's contributing to, you know, to the polarization in this country. Being able to have that conversation with people who being in a position to have that conversation with people who have historically been deniers, I think is, hats off to him for having that conversation. And, you know, obviously we do need to limit, carbon, and putting a price on it is absolutely an important way that we can do that. I think it is important to note that, you know, the momentum that we're seeing on climate change is in part because of a willingness and a increasing willingness to limit carbon, and we've certainly seen examples of that in a few regions, in a few states, and, you know, obviously in Paris, the beginnings of a international, a durable international commitment to do that. But, you know, a price on carbon, you know, needs to be complemented by other measures that ease the way for the shift from dirty to clean. And so, you know, we need to do, you know, we need strong policies to ensure that we have strict limits on carbon, and, you know, we need programs to ensure that we get rid of some of the bumps in the road investment in, you know, energy efficiency and renewables and others. I mean, you can put a price on carbon to send somebody a signal that they should take the bus to work. But, you know, if there isn't a bus going by their house, you're just going to have a backlash, right? You need to have, you know, good, strong transportation policies and good, strong, that promote, low carbon transportation options and, you know, the renewables that we're, you know, advances that we're seeing are because of good policies as well.
Absolutely. Great work. Well, that's all the time we have.
Yep.
Rob Sargent of Environment America, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your great work on the environment.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.